Lauren Bacall has been a star of stage and screen for more than 60 years now. Her 1979 autobiography, By Myself, was a New York Times bestseller and the winner of the National Book Award. Last year, she brought us up to date on her life since then with a new bestseller, By Myself, and Then Some. And now she's made that book, or that book has been made available in paperback by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased it has brought Lauren Bacall back to my show. Hello, it's always a pleasure to see you. So has life over the last 25 years been anywhere near as exciting as the first 50-odd years were?
I'm sorry, I did not hear what you said.
Okay, we're going to put the headphones on you.
Okay.
I wondered whether life over the last 25 years has been anywhere near as exciting as the first 50-odd years were.
Well, I would say probably not, except for my theater experiences. My first musical, Applause, in 1970. And that was a highlight for me. Really, I reached a high point for my career because I always wanted to be in a musical, and I finally made it.
Because your early days were, you wanted to be a dancer as well.
I wanted to be a dancer. I studied for 13 years, and I wanted to be a ballerina. Then I studied tap, and I wanted to dance with Fred Astaire, and it never quite happened. Excuse me, I have to pick up my dog because she's speaking to me. When she speaks to me, I have to pick her up. Come here, Sophie.
So when you were a nice Jewish girl growing up in New York, you imagined you'd be a dancer. You had no idea that acting would have been in the future?
Actually, that's not quite true, because when I realized I couldn't be a ballerina, I also wanted to be an actress. And I saw Loretta Young in a movie in which she played a nurse, and then I thought I wanted to be a nurse for about 10 minutes. Because it was the White Parade, it was very glamorous. And then I used to cut school to see Betty Davis in everything. And I wanted to be an actress, but I wanted to be on the stage.
And then you got a chance to meet her when you were 15.
I did, but my goal was never to be in movies myself, which is so weird. And I did get a chance to meet her when I was 15, and I was beside myself with nerves. And she was very charming, very nice, and very matter-of-fact, as Betty Davis was. And
did you maintain a friendship later years when you...
No, she's not easy. She came to Applause because I was playing Margot Channing, a part that she created and that will live forever with her, because film is forever and the theater is not. But she said she only came... She told me that... she told the company who invited her to see the show that she would only go with a proviso that I did not know she was there and that there were no cameras. And, of course, I did not know she was there, thank God, until after.
That would have made you nervous?
Oh, and how? Are you kidding?
Even after all those years in the business?
Well, I get nervous very easily. I'm always nervous on opening nights and things. I get very nervous. But I was nervous because Betty Davis... And there I am playing her part, although it is a musical still and all, it's hers. And you never lose that angst, you know, that you have about somebody that I idolized her, and I think that stayed with me. I still think she's the best ever in movies.
Do you think that's something that happens with actors in general? You grow up admiring somebody, you're a fan, and then one day you're working with this person, and you have to work out some kind of a compromise between being, you know, oh my God, it's Jimmy Stewart, and on the other hand, it's I have to perform here, and the rest of the world, I'm equal to this person.
Well, I know it's very odd. Well, I never thought I was equal to her, but it was strange because after Applause, a few years after that, I was quite a few years after that actually, in 1981, I think it was. I starred in Woman of the Year, which was Katie Hepburn. So it was so curious that I was playing Betty Davis's part and then Katharine Hepburn's part. And Katharine Hepburn and I were great friends. She was a much more open, kind of giving human than Betty Davis was.
So did you know that she was in the audience?
Betty Davis?
No, Katharine Hepburn.
Katharine Hepburn. No, no, because she wasn't in the audience. No, she wasn't in the audience when I was in Woman of the Year.
She never
I think
came.
She was in California, or she was she was traveling somewhere. She always came to everything, you know. I think she came at some point, but obviously I never knew because she knew that I never wanted to know who was in the audience.
Do you see your career as being a mix of obvious talent and luck? Because there were any number of serendipitous things that happened, whether it was the date with Burgess Meredith when you were young to appearing in
when I was jailbait.
but he was okay.
He was very sweet with me, actually.
Then you do a modeling assignment. You were not you're not someone who did a lot of modeling. You do a modeling assignment, and that leads
to a
Hollywood career.
Well, the Harper's Bazaar stuff, that was pure luck, accident, you know. And it was not planned by me, and it was just because of a friend of mine who knew Nikki de Gainsbourg, who happened to be a vice president of the Bazaar, who sent me to Diana Vreeland, and the rest, she did the rest. So, I mean, in that respect, it was luck. But my movie career has not been a great one, actually. It started off fantastically. And then it hit rock bottom. The second movie that I was in that came out hit rock bottom. Then with A Big Sleep, it kind of went back again a little bit. But it never reached the peak that it was in To Have and Have Not. I was thought of mostly as Bogey's wife, which, of course, was very okay with me because that's what I wanted more than anything. But then once you want to act, you want to act. You
but
know?
You've also won many awards, so there.
Well, not in movies. I guess I won a couple of Golden Globes, and which was lovely, and some others. You know, actually, The Mirror Has Two Faces, I won quite a few, all except, you know, The Plum.
Yes. In fact, Juliette Binoche won it, to everyone's surprise.
Oh, yes. Don't mention that name to me.
Lauren Bacall is here. Her New York Times bestseller, By Myself and Then Some, has been made available now in paperback and is published by Harper. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. But you went from being Betty Bacall, an usher on Broadway, to Lauren Bacall, the star of the show. And you actually ushered at a production of Noel Coward's Blythe Spirit and then went on to star in it some years later.
I don't want to upset you, but I did not usher at Blythe Spirit.
Oh.
I met Noel Coward because Bogey and he had been friends for years in the theater because they were contemporaries. And Bogey, remember, was 25 years my senior. And that's how I got to know all of these fabulous people. And I still can't believe I've known all the people that I've known, but largely due to Bogey.
Or we could say first Howard Hawks and his wife. Because they really were the keys, weren't they?
Well, they were the keys to the movie life, to my career.
And didn't he also suggest that you talk in the lower register?
Well, I always did have a low voice. I mean, my mother had a low voice. My daughter has a low voice. But he wanted me to, he said, you know, in a scene, whenever women get excited, their voices always go up high, and I want yours to remain low. And that was the main reason that I read aloud. Uh-huh. So, in my car alone, in Mulholland Drive in California. But, anything that Howard suggested, obviously I did, because he was the old gray fox, you know.
One of the greatest directors that ever lived.
Yeah.
We should point out that you have been chosen one of the 25 best actresses of all time by the AFI, so that's okay.
I don't know. That's kind of a shock to me, because I don't think, frankly, I don't think the movie industry gives much of a damn about me and my work. I just think that they're so into, it's run by different kinds of people now, and it's they're interested mostly in who's making $20 million a movie, and I, unfortunately, am not one of those. I think it's always indicative of kind of what goes on in this country, that as you get older, you ought to be dismissed. That, and in the movie world, you know, you have to be, the younger you are, the better. And after you've reached a certain point, like, say, 26, you're out, you know, and they're often running with the next group.
Although in the case of Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, you were just in horror movies. That's what they started doing. They started doing it.
Well, Bette Davis, yes, Bette Davis was a real actress. Bette Davis would not stop working. She lived to work. And I understand that because I feel very much the same way. But Bette Davis was a wonderful actress.
Yes.
Real big talent.
Wasn't the famous Just Whistle invitation your screen test scene? In To Have and Have Not, which would have suggested that they knew even then that this was something quite special.
Well, I don't know. Howard Hawks had been thinking about what to do with me, you know. Once he signed me to a contract, he told me he wanted to put me in a movie either with Humphrey Bogart or Cary Grant. And, of course, I immediately thought, Cary Grant, fabulous, God, I'm ready. And I was this kid.
And did you feel ready, really?
No, I was ready to meet Cary Grant, but I thought, how excited. I was totally excited. I wasn't so thrilled with Bogart because I had just seen him in Casablanca when I was like 15 or 16, you know, in New York at the Capitol Theater. But I thought he was a good actor, but that was it. But Cary Grant, that was something else. And so he finally ended up thinking that I should be in a movie with Bogart. And he had it all figured out because Howard Hawks was a really interesting man. I first of all think he was a great movie maker. I don't think he was a genius like John Huston was a genius, but I think he was a great movie maker. And he always wanted to create a star out of an unknown, and he had never been able to do it. He tried with Rita Hayworth, and he tried with Lombard, and he tried with a few others, and it never worked until I came along. And it did. It worked with a vengeance with me. But along with that came his giant disappointment. He thought he was going to control my life, and I think he had designs on me as well, which, of course, God forbid, I never thought of it for myself. And Bogey got in the way.
How soon after you met did you fall in love?
After we met. We met first early on when he was making another movie, just how do you do. Mm-hmm. When we started shooting, I hung on every word that Howard Hawks said. Bogey was there and okay, blah, blah, but nothing happened at all for me. I didn't have any designs on him, certainly. And Howard told Bogey, he said, well, you know, kid around with her a little bit because it will relax her, because I was so nervous. I was just terrified all the time. And
it does not come across in the film.
Well, you can blame Hawks for that. He had every shot. He and the cameraman, Sid Hickox, were planning this. They had a special light for me, and they called it the baby light and the thing in the shadows, you know, because it was black and white. So to put a shadow going across half my face and have a three-quarters angle, you know, I mean, he did things that I had no idea of. I had no idea that they would be as effective as they were. I never thought of it anyway as being I would suddenly make me this booming name. But the Bogey thing is what happened. It just happened gradually, but not the first several weeks that we were working, nothing in my happened to me, but obviously something happened to him. Thank God.
Well, this is not unusual that people wind up co-starring in a film and then become...
But it's a very bad habit. If there's one thing I learned from Bogey, it is that you never mix business with pleasure. You, at 6 o'clock, when the work is finished, you go home, and that's your real life, and you keep them separate, and you do not, because there are actors and actresses that are in bed with every co-star. Well, they'd be so busy, they wouldn't have time to play a part. So, I mean, every now and then, something real happens, and unfortunately, in our case, it was real, thank God.
Was your life together as romantic as your fans would have thought?
Well, I think it was romantic. It was very short, unfortunately. But it was romantic For the first 3.5 years, I was on a cloud until the first child was born. Till the minute I became pregnant, you know, but suddenly I was going to be a mother, but I was going to give Bogey what he never had. He never had had children. And, but always, Bogey was a romantic. So it was always there. He always suddenly would buy me a present for no reason. He hated to be told that it was, you know, he had to buy a gift at Christmas. He had to buy it on your birthday. He liked to do it just for nothing, you know. And, of course, I was thrilled. And I was so young and so filled with trying to discover everything about life at once, you know, and I was not ready for that, really. And for me to suddenly be running a house and, you know, be married and suddenly have a child and then have fame and then want to work and then, you know, I mean, it was so much stuff at once and trying to absorb it. After all, I was 19, you know, and I didn't know anything about anything.
We have to only wonder what would have happened if the co-star instead had been Cary Grant. Lauren Bacall is my guest. Her autobiography, By Myself and Then Some, was a New York Times bestseller when it was released in hardcover last year, now available in paperback from Harper. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Lauren Bacall, whose memoir or biography, autobiography, whatever, I'm not exactly sure what the difference is sometimes, By Myself and Then Some, is now available in paperback from Harper's. You said that you really haven't worked all that much. Well, you've been in The Sopranos. You were in Birth in 2004 with Nicole Kidman. I mean,
yes. I have kept working because I do keep working. But my movie career has not been probably what it would have been had I suppose, remained single. I don't know. But in any event, I didn't, and thank God I didn't. But I just...
Two films with Lars von Trier.
Yes, no, I keep working. You don't misunderstand me. I'm a worker. I was brought up to be a worker, and that's what my mother did, and that's what I do. And I love it. And unfortunately, I'm in a profession that is very difficult, and particularly difficult for women, because writers don't seem to be writing parts for adults very much, and they want the 20-year-old girls, and they want the money guys. You know, the first five big money makers have their own deals that they make and their own choices, and the rest of us are just floundering around hoping to God we can get a part.
Well, you actually can have a much longer career if you're a man than if you're a woman, and I guess that's the way it's always been in Hollywood. And when you first started, you had a bit of a reputation for being difficult. Do you think that was sexism?
No, why do you think I had that reputation?
Perhaps because you were assertive.
Well, I mean, of course, the big mistake is to tell the truth. I mean, that is what you're not supposed to do.
Because Katharine Hepburn had a similar reputation.
Yeah, well, you're supposed to play the game all the time, you know, and you're supposed to constantly smile and anything you say, sir, yes, I'm with you. Well, I mean, I just, you know, when you're brought up in New York and you grow up alone, I had just my mother. She was my only parent, really, that was there for me. And you learned to defend yourself and to take care of yourself. And before they get you, you've got to, you know. And also I was brought up to read and to be informed and to know what was going on in the country and the world. And so I suppose, as with Bogey, you know, whenever they asked him what he thought, he would tell them. And they'd say, oh, you wouldn't say that, would you? He'd say, well, don't ask me.
Well, he got in a lot of trouble early in his career. In fact, it was only because George Raft turned down a part in High Sierra that he actually made the big breakthrough. And George Raft didn't want to do it because the character died at the end. He didn't want to be in a film where he died.
And he also didn't want to be in a movie where he cheated women at cards, which was, I forget what movie that was, They Drive by Night or something. And but Bogey said what Raft didn't realize was that he cheated so that they would win.
Maybe Graff did realize that. You became friends with Katharine Hepburn after she appeared with Bogey in The African Queen?
Yes. I didn't really know her until we went to London and started on that great, fabulous experience going to Africa. And she was fantastic, always open with me, made it easy, laughed. She was friendly. She was, you know, Bette Davis was not at all like that, unhappily. But Katie was a very unusual woman anyway, in every way. She was totally independent and totally, she was a worker and she knew what she was doing.
And you said John Huston was a genius. He made African Queen. Did you ever work for him?
Yes, Key Largo.
Oh. That's really early.
Which was a great, very popular, it still is an extremely popular movie. That was 1949, I think. I loved working with him. He was marvelous with actors.
And then you worked alongside Marilyn Monroe and Betty Grable in How to Marry a Millionaire.
Well, that was great fun. That was great fun. That was produced by Nunnally Johnson, who was one of my dearest friends, and directed by Johnny Negulesco, who also was a friend. And I've worked with Johnny a few times, a couple of soap operas, not so good. But
well, most of us only know him as Jean.
Yes, Jean Negulesco.
So was Marilyn Monroe as difficult to work with as her reputation would have it?
Is her reputation that?
Marilyn Monroe, yes. She was always coming to the set late and forgetting her lines and all of that, according to the legend.
Well, I don't know who starts what is called the legend, you know. I mean, I'm so sick of people who are constantly knocking it. I mean, if they can't knock you, that's their reason for being. If you know some of these critics and the way they criticize plays and things and actors, what their response to acting to a performance is they don't know a damn thing about how a performance is gotten, who does what in our play or in a movie. Marilyn was late a lot of the time, but Marilyn was also frightened. She needed reassurance all the time. And the only thing that she felt good about was her body. But she was fine to work with, but she worked alone, kind of. But she was sweet. She was she wasn't mean. She had none of that aggressive kind of, I'll get you, you know, this is mine, I'm a big star and you're nothing. And believe me, I know a few actresses that are like that. But Marilyn was nothing like that. Well, Grable was fantastic. She was a funny, adorable woman. But Marilyn, I mean, she would come into my dressing room. I never really got to know her, though.
Well, you were already a bigger star than you were already a star when she came along.
So yeah, there but was we that. Were, we were the same generation, though, in actual fact, as it turns out. And she, I mean, I met her. She went around with her agent for a long time. I forget the agency that she was with, but Johnny Hyde. And he was a lovely guy, and he kind of discovered her, and he trained her, and she adored him, and then he died. And she used to come into my dressing room during Millionaire, and she'd say, well, I really just want to be with Joe. I want to be eating spaghetti up in San Francisco. And I thought, I don't think that's right somehow, but okay, Marilyn. You know, and she needed somebody there for her all the time. And that's not being difficult.
You said that your mother made sure that you knew what was going on in the world, and you came along at a time when the Cold War was starting. You famously sat on Harry Truman's piano when you were very young. But then came the blacklist and the anti-communist witch hunts, and you didn't hold your tongue. Do you think that hurt you at all?
I don't. I don't think so. I never
because
really
you weren't a member
of,
of the party yourself. So
God no, no. Neither was Bogey. I mean, we had nothing to do with communism at all. We had to do with being able to speak your mind. J. Parnell Thomas, the Un-American Activities Committee. There were a lot of Hollywood stars like Gary Cooper and Duke Wayne and a few others who testified and said, oh, yeah, there was some infiltration in a couple of scripts. Yeah, that guy, you know, they thought Democrats were communists. Any Democrat was a communist. But I think that, I don't think it, at the time, the studios led us to believe that it was tough. Not for me as much as for Bogey and Gene Kelly and Danny Kaye. And Danny Kaye had a priest or something he went to, and they cleared him. And Gene, I don't remember who he talked to, but and Bogey finally made a statement that he regretted making always, because he didn't do anything wrong. None of us did anything wrong. We were there protesting the methods that were being used by this horrible excuse for a congressman who, J. Parnell Thomas, it turned out, who had his whole family on his payroll. You know, he was a nightmare and very crooked.
Now, you co-starred with John Wayne in The Shootist, his last film. So politics didn't play a role in who you would appear with. But you did turn down an opportunity to be in a film with Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, well, of course, it was a terrible script.
It had nothing to do with politics.
No, it was Stallion Road. It was one of them. Reagan at the time was playing in kind of B pictures. He was not a giant star. And I didn't want Jack Warner, first of all, to choose the parts for me, because when he chose the second movie that was released that I starred in, that almost finished my career. And so
That was
Confidential Agent. So I said, never again will Jack Warner make a choice for me. And he wanted me to be in everything because he was paying me a salary every week, a small salary, by the way. But I didn't turn it down because of Ronald Reagan. I turned it down because it was a horrible script.
Well, speaking of politics, is it true that Shimon Peres is your cousin?
I think so. You know, he and I, we've met a couple of times, and I admire him a lot. He's terrific, wonderful, wonderful man, brilliant man. And I met him when I was in Israel. I was in Israel making a movie, Appointment with Death, a disaster movie. And I went to his office, and that was the first time I'd met him. And then when he came to America, and he was in New York for something, I don't remember what it was, several years ago, and we met again. And I guess we are, but I'm not sure.
Is it different?
I mean, because it would be on my father's side, and I don't... Anything to do with my father, of course, needless to say.
Well, maybe he is, maybe he isn't, but that's part...
My father was not a quality guy.
I wondered about living in the public eye. You've had to deal with gossip columnists. They say they're worse today than they were in the past, but I'm not so sure.
No, they're not.
A gossip column soured a romance you had with Frank Sinatra, didn't it?
Oh, yeah, but no, but they were much more influential then.
Mm-hmm. Well, Luella Parsons.
Well, Luella Parsons, of course, was employed by Hearst. And the Hearst Press were the most powerful of all. And she's the one who printed the thing about Sinatra. But she printed it because the person who told her that we were going to be wed, that we were engaged, told her and had no right to tell her and didn't tell me or Frank that he was doing that. But Luella, who was a sharp woman, printed it, big black letters on the Los Angeles Examiner. Horrible.
Now, you were married to Jason Robards for 8 years. I get the impression from your book that almost everybody in Hollywood drank to excess. But was Jason Robards just more excessive than the others?
No, wait a minute. You gave the impression that everyone...
Well, a lot of people were drinking throughout.
Well, social drinkers.
Yeah.
Well, when you go to a party, you have a drink, don't you?
But was it Jason Robards drinking that?
Well, Jason was an alcoholic, and I didn't know what an alcoholic was. And that's a big difference between just having a few drinks at a party. Even if you get a little looped, that doesn't make you an alcoholic. And it's a different thing. It's a real illness. And I adored Jason, and Jason, me. We really cared about one another, and he was a great actor and a charming, lovely, very appealing man. And he had so many wonderful qualities, but I finally just found I couldn't live with the drinking, with the just not knowing, you know, whether I would see him or not see him.
Thank you so much for being with us. The book, By Myself and Then Some, now available in paperback from Harper's.